Behind the argument that independent states should be let alone and not judged by international human rights standards, one finds the primacy of national sovereignty. This is the first line of defense against the universality of human rights, and it is always deployed to reject norms established by the international community. Although initially it may be couched in cultural terms, in pleas for tolerance and in calls for diversity rather than conformity, this argument has a defiantly political purpose. It uses national sovereignty to reject any ideas that are politically inimical to a country's leadership. According to this logic, state leaders alone are the ultimate deciders. They have the final say in how to govern their people. No neighboring nation, no external coalition of nations, and certainly no international institution supported by the majority of nations in the world can impose its values or guidelines, its models or principles on that sovereign state. No external power, whether political or economic or cultural, has the right to influence its policies. And to attempt to do this, to suggest the need to do it, to claim the authority to do it on the grounds of human rights is tantamount to an assault, an act of war. It is perceived as undermining the sovereignty, as threatening the security, and as violating the independence of that nation. This implicit and sometimes explicit accusation immediately politicizes the definition of culture. It opens up a minefield. It turns the word into a weapon and hurls verbal missiles and language bombs into the debate. But on closer scrutiny, the logical weaknesses of this argument are evident. Even when not using democratic criteria based on corrupted or distorted statistics to bolster its legitimacy, leadership needs some evidence of its validity. If this is asserted on the basis of force rather than freely granted popular support, then it is most likely to be tyrannical. The great English historian Edward Gibbon long ago noted that claims of legitimacy are most vociferous when references to the abuse of rule are most absent. As he famously stated in his analysis of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, quote, "It is sufficiently known that the odious appellation of tyrant was often employed by the ancients to express the illegal seizure of supreme power without any reference to the abuse of it," unquote. The claims of those who deny such abuse, however, are rarely disinterested and hardly objective. When leaders hold on to power at the cost of the rights and freedoms of others, their legitimacy is most likely to be self-serving and least likely to be freely granted. And when half of the population they claim to represent has been forcibly silenced, the motives of a particular elite may be considered patently suspect. In such cases, a government rarely represents all the people of its country, for it almost never speaks on behalf of its women. Under the Taliban, for example, women neither chose their government nor were asked about who they wanted as their spokesman. They were never consulted about whether they could join the labor force or if their daughters might go to school. These choices were appropriated by the men, controlled by men, and dictated by those men who claimed to speak on behalf of Afghan society. And it was these same male leaders who, in the name of national sovereignty, forced women to bear the brunt of their insecurities, who, under the guise of protecting their culture and traditions, denied women their right to vote, to be educated, to earn money, to own property, or to travel freely. In other words, the majority of those who thought that such evident and universal rights would shake the stability and undermine the national sovereignty of the country were men. It would seem, therefore, by a curious twist of irony, that the solemn and sacred subject of national identity has in some countries become inextricably entangled with women's clothing and women's jobs. But one need not refer to extreme cases to see evidence of such violations of legitimate spokesmanship at work. Frank, tells the fascinating case of Sandra Lovelace, a Canadian Maliseet native who lost her rights to live on ancestral lands because she married out of the tribe. In 1979, she took her case to the Human Rights Committee of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, arguing that no similar penalty applied to men. The committee upheld her claim. This in turn forced the Canadian government, eager to abide by its international human rights obligations, to repeal what was clearly a discriminatory tribal law in 1985. Upon closer examination, however, anthropologists noted that a rule that appeared on the surface to have been a manifestation of some tribal customs adopted in ancient times, perhaps to facilitate group survival, was in fact copied relatively recently from male-dominated Victorian society and imposed by male elders on the women of these First Nation peoples. Moreover, paraphrasing Radhika Kumaraswamy, the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, Frank claims that practices such as female genital mutilation, flogging, stoning, and amputation, as well as laws restricting women's right to marriage, divorce, maintenance, and custody, are inauthentic perversions of religious dogma rather than cultural norms. Accordingly, the criterion of free choice is all that can resolve the conflict between human rights and issues of cultural pluralism. Quote, cultural diversity should be celebrated only if those enjoying their cultural attributes are doing so voluntarily, unquote, Kumaraswamy states. Quote, by protecting choice, voluntariness, and the integrity of female decision-making, we may be able to reconcile the dilemma between cultural diversity and the need for the protection of women's human rights, unquote. If the claims of legitimate spokesmanship are not voluntarily supported by the majority on the basis of free choice, then this argument against the universality of human rights is clearly flawed, which leads to the second line of defense.